See you right after the international news.
Today is Friday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedwafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. and South Korea review and update ways to deter North Korea's missile and weapons development.
We also reaffirmed our shared assessment that the DPRK is continuing to advance its missile and weapons programs, which is increasingly destabilizing for regional security.
The United Nations appeals for $41 billion to help 189 million of the world's most vulnerable people suffering from multiple crises.
UN officials report an estimated 274 million people worldwide will require emergency aid and protection next year.
And Chancellor Angela Merkel calls on Germans to stand up to hatred at a military ceremony bidding her farewell after 16 years in office. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The defense chiefs of the United States and South Korea said on Thursday they would review and update ways to deter North Korea, even as they emphasize a growing regional role for Seoul. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said after talks with his South Korean counterpart, Soon Wong, that North Korea's missiles and weapons developments are increasingly destabilizing for regional security, but the two sides also discussed issues beyond the Korean Peninsula. Sir said a changing security environment prompted the United States and South Korea to agree to update strategic guidance about how they plan for a potential conflict with North Korea, as well as review their combined military command. U.S. and South Korean officials cautioned that the updates to the contingency war plans are routine and not a preparation for war. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
We also reaffirmed our shared assessment that the DPRK is continuing to advance its missile and weapons programs, which is increasingly destabilizing for regional security. The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats. We also approved new strategic planning guidance, an important step forward to frame forthcoming alliance planning efforts. And I would just point out that the hypersonic capability is a capability, but certainly not the only capability that the PRC has a capability to develop. And my job is to focus on the broader picture and to make sure that we can defend ourselves against any and all threats. Okay, regarding the AUKUS agreement, that agreement is specific to Australia. It answers some of Australia's pressing needs. And it's in the initial stages of development there, and we're going to work very hard to address requirements going forward. Whatever we do will be done as a part of an international community. The best case, though, is that we won't see an incursion by the Soviet Union into Ukraine. And so we would hope that Putin would be a lot more transparent, and we would work to resolve issues and concerns and lower the temperature in the region.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. North Korean state-run television KRT reports that leader Kim Jong-un has said the country must be prepared for, quote, a very giant struggle, unquote, next year to continue to make progress in areas including defense, agriculture, and construction. Kim made the remarks at a meeting of the Central Committee of the ruling Workers' Party's Politburo. We decided to hold a plenary meeting of the committee next month. According to state media, Kim said that while the country still faces economic difficulties, the party has had success in pushing to meet policy targets and implementing the five-year economic plan he unveiled earlier this year. Kim has sought to boost the economy and power supply with his plan, but UN agencies have said food and electricity shortages remain, exacerbated by sanctions imposed over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, the COVID-19 pandemic, and natural disasters. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met his Russian opposite number on Thursday to warn him face-to-face of the, quote, serious consequences, unquote, Russia would suffer if it invaded Ukraine, and to urge him to seek a diplomatic exit from the crisis. Blinken delivered the warning to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov at a meeting in Stockholm, a day after declaring that Washington was ready to respond resolutely, including with hard-hitting sanctions in the event of a Russian attack. He said Russia and Ukraine should each fully implement their obligations under the 2014 Minsk peace process designed to end a war between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian government forces in the east of the former Soviet Republic. Washington was willing to facilitate this, Blinken said, but, quote, if Russia decides to pursue confrontation, there will be serious consequences, unquote. Lavrov told reporters Moscow was ready for dialogue with Kyiv. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The best way to avert crisis is through diplomacy. And that's what I look forward to discussing with Sergei. If Russia decides to pursue confrontation, there will be serious consequences. At the same time as we're discussing this, we have shared interests that we are working on together, including a shared interest in Iran not acquiring a nuclear weapon. I will raise the cases of Trevor Reed and Paul Whelan, two Americans who have been unjustly detained for far too long in Russia. Their release is an absolute priority for the United States, one that President Biden raises on every occasion.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told his U.S. counterpart Antony Blinken on Thursday that President Vladimir Putin has made clear that Moscow did not want a new conflict over Ukraine despite tensions running high in the region. Lavrov spoke at the start of talks with Blinken on the sidelines of a meeting in Stockholm of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Ukraine says Russia has amassed more than 90,000 troops near their long-shared border, while Moscow accuses Kyiv of pursuing its own military buildup. It has dismissed as inflammatory suggestions it is preparing for an attack on Ukraine and has defended its right to deploy troops on its own territory as it sees fit. The Kremlin said on Thursday that the probability of a new conflict in eastern Ukraine remained high and that Moscow was concerned by, quote, aggressive, unquote, rhetoric from Kyiv and an increase in what it called provocative actions along the line of contact between government forces and pro-Russian separatists. Amid growing concerns over the new Omicron COVID-19 variant, the Biden administration is supporting efforts by the World Health Organization to establish a new international agreement on future pandemic preparedness and response, the so-called Pandemic Treaty. But as White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadaskwara reports, public health experts are pessimistic of the outcome.
At least 55 countries have implemented travel restrictions aimed at delaying the outbreak of the Omicron COVID-19 variant. Chief Medical Advisor to the U.S. President, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Confirmed cases as of yesterday was 205 in 18 countries, and just this morning, that's gone up to 226 in 20 countries. And I think you're going to expect to see those numbers change rapidly.
As countries scramble to ramp up vaccinations, the Biden administration is supporting efforts by the World Health Organization to establish a new international agreement on future pandemic preparedness and response, said White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki to VOA on board Air Force One Tuesday.
The United States is committed to working with member states to take forward the recent recommendations of the Working Group on Preparedness and Response. That includes developing a new WHO convention agreement or other international instrument and making agreements to improve the effectiveness and agility of international health regulations.
The U.S. had initially opposed the inclusion of language that would have made the so-called pandemic treaty proposed in March by about 24 world leaders legally binding. The treaty is expected to be ready in May 2024. Krishna Uday Kumar is the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center at Duke University.
Anything that comes out of this process is very unlikely to make any change to our current environment and the current pandemic response. We're looking at probably a 2 to 3 year process to get to a real treaty that may or may not actually then go into effect.
Meanwhile, humanitarian organizations say that a pandemic treaty should include a waiver of patents on vaccines, the so-called TRIPS waiver at the World Trade Organization.
Vaccinate the world! Free the vaccine!
After initially opposing the waiver, the U.S. announced its support of it in April, leaving the U.K., Switzerland, and the European Union as holdouts. But many are skeptical that the Biden administration is putting any real diplomatic weight on the issue. Yuan Chong-Hu is Senior Legal and Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign.
We do observe the lacking of more proactive leadership from the U.S. Since it's changed the position.
According to research by Duke University, almost 2 years into the pandemic, the world continues to struggle to enact an effective and equitable response.
Commitments and pledges remain largely unfulfilled, including the goal of achieving 40% vaccination coverage in every country by the end of 2021 and 70% coverage by mid-2022. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Experts say the sudden travel ban imposed on South Africa in the past week over the Omicron variant has dealt a blow to an already struggling economy. The jobless rate is creeping up to affect half the population, and the lost tourism this month will have far-reaching impacts beyond the travel sector. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
The Hector Peterson Memorial and Museum at the center of the apartheid struggle in South Africa is normally bustling with tourists. Since the recent discovery of the Omicron coronavirus variant, foreign tourists have vanished. Britain was the first to halt flights to South Africa, with the United States and other countries quickly following suit. People working in the tourism industry say panic over the new variant is decimating business, just as travel was starting to pick up over the past 2 months. Wayne Barnes is a sales manager with Mo Africa Tours.
When the UK actually opened up and took us off their red list, we started to see an increase of numbers from travelers from all around the world started to support us again. So their decisions is definitely affecting, you know, everybody around the world on their decisions.
And the decision blindsided many. Barnes says his company lost over $30,000 to refunds in just 1 day for canceled December bookings. Tour guides like Tabanga Molea went from leading groups of over 40 people last week to no one today.
I'm very hurt at the moment, namely because things were starting to look like we're starting to be working normally, that which will remind us of a life before COVID.
It's not just the tourism industry that's hurting. From vehicle suppliers to website developers, the collapse of travel is having a domino effect across the economy. Nearly 47% of South Africans were jobless last quarter, according to government statistics released this week. It's a bleak landscape for parents and breadwinners like Tabanga Molea, who are again facing layoffs.
At some point, I wanted to come up with an idea of what one can do. Also, it was not easy for one to find a new job, but just hoping and believing that one day one will work again. The world will travel again.
But economists say recovery is years away, and locking down will only slow that recovery and make life harder for the poorest. Davi Root is chief economist for the Efficient Group in Pretoria.
The biggest killer out there is not a virus or TB or AIDS or anything. The biggest killer out there is poverty. It might be necessary to prevent larger crowds to get together and things like that, but it's not necessarily necessary to stop airlines from flying and to necessarily stop people from going, stay at home, not go to work, or stay at home and not go to the factories and things like that.
For those who have managed to cling to their jobs, like Johannesburg Tourism Ambassador Mbali Ngema, the situation still feels demoralizing.
Before, you used to have that thing of waking up in the morning to say, I'm going to work, I'm going to see new people, I'm going to meet new people. But due to this, you just wake up and you sit and you do nothing.
Until scientists better understand the Omicron variant and politicians change their views on travel, South Africans will have to continue waiting for normal life to return. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
As the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on a state law that would restrict abortion rights, protests echoed in Washington on both sides of America's decade-old debate over the controversial issue. VOA's Caroline Presutti reports.
A challenge to abortion rights in America, with loud outdoor protests that could be heard inside the court. The Supreme Court Wednesday considered a Mississippi state law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The burning question now, will justices overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that found a constitutional right to abortion? Kathy Renna was at the protest.
This is the greatest challenge to Roe versus Wade in decades.
The Mississippi law reduces the time frame when women can choose abortion. The Centers for Disease Control shows most all abortions, 92%, take place in the first 13 weeks of pregnancy. That's before the Mississippi ban would apply. Krista Corbello and Savannah Ackerman want the court to restrict abortions.
I think abortion is kind of barbaric. It's an old practice. Abortion has been failing women and families for over 50 years.
I mean, any life saved is, you know, monumental, but I think also we're looking right at now putting the ban right about where every other country in the world does it.
a comment echoed by some in Congress. Republican Senator Steve Daines spoke ahead of Wednesday's court action.
We have the opportunity to end an extreme judicially imposed abortion regime that's aligned with nations such as China and North Korea. The United States is just one of seven nations that allows late-term abortions.
On the other side, those who feel women have the right to end pregnancies without government interference, like Democratic Representative Lois Frankel and protester Allison Turcos.
It's about politicians controlling women's bodies. It's about politicians taking away the personal decision of people to access the health care that they need.
I've never had an abortion myself, but there is a chance that I might need one day. And this is just about abortion justice and liberating abortion.
President Joe Biden backs the current law.
I support Roe v. Wade. I think it's a rational position to take.
Abortion opponents are counting on the Supreme Court's 6-3 conservative majority to deliver them a long-sought victory. During the oral arguments, Justice Sonia Sotomayor warned of damage to the court if it is seen as bending to political pressure.
If people actually believe that it's all political, how will we survive?
Upholding the Mississippi law would open the door to other states passing similarly restrictive laws. Chief Justice John Roberts.
Viability, it seems to me, doesn't have anything to do with choice. But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time?
The Supreme Court will announce its decision next year. Carolyn Frasutti, VOA News.
The United Nations is appealing for a record $41 billion to help 183 million people of the world's most vulnerable suffering from multiple crises, including poverty, hunger, conflict, and the impact of COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the launch of the UN's Global Humanitarian Plan for 2022.
UN officials report an estimated 274 million people worldwide will require emergency aid and protection next year. This is a 17% increase from 2021. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths cites long-lasting conflicts, political instability, failing economies, climate crisis, and the COVID-19 pandemic as the main drivers of need.
There are 45 million people at risk of famine worldwide. 1% of humanity is displaced. And it will be no surprise to any of us that women and girls continue to suffer the most, just as civilians continue to suffer the most in war.
Griffiths says humanitarian aid can limit the worst consequences of existing and emerging crises. For example, he says UN aid brought back 500,000 people from the brink of famine in South Sudan this year. He says aid agencies delivered health care for 10 million people in Yemen and helped vaccinate millions of others against killer diseases in Myanmar. While aid does save lives, he notes it is no solution. He says humanitarian aid does not replace development assistance.
And we see in many countries, Afghanistan is just one most recent example, humanitarian assistance is not a remedy for the people of Afghanistan. It isn't a way to stabilize societies. One of the tragedies of the situation in Ethiopia that we see now as a result of that conflict is the erosion of the development gains of the last 40 years.
Griffiths considers the crisis in Ethiopia to be the most alarming in terms of immediate emergency needs. He notes 9 million people in northern Ethiopia's Amhara, Afar, and Tigray regions are seriously short of food. Of those, he says 5 million people in Tigray are suffering from acute hunger, with 400,000 on the verge of famine. He says he's very worried about the rebel military advance on the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, warning it will have a seismic effect on the rest of the country, engulfing the entire region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Human Rights Chief has called for increased efforts to protect the vulnerable in Burkina Faso's growing conflict with Islamic militants. Rights groups say Burkina Faso has struggled to uphold human rights during its long-running conflict with armed groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso's capital.
Michelle Bachelet, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, held a press conference in Ouagadougou Wednesday at the end of a three-day visit to Burkina Faso. It was the first time a UN human rights chief had visited the country. Her office said in October it was setting up a presence in the country to support the government. Bachelet noted the challenging context of a six-year conflict with armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State group, and local banditry. She cited allegations of summary executions, abductions, forced disappearances, and sexual violence by violent extremist groups, local defence groups, national security and defence forces, among others. A woman who escaped the unrest told VOA earlier this week about how her husband was abducted one night from an internally displaced person's camp close to the town of Waguya. Asked who took her husband, she said, "I don't know if they were volunteers or security, but I know they weren't terrorists." She added, "The only thing I want right now is to be sure that nothing will happen to me and my family. The message I have for the government is to make sure that we stay alive where we are now." Burkinabe authorities did not respond to a request for an interview on this abduction. Rights groups have said that extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances by security forces are widespread in Burkina Faso, with hundreds of families having lost relatives. Asked what the new UN Human Rights Office could do to prevent attacks on the civilian population, Bachelet said,
And we believe that these attacks must stop immediately, those attacks against the population, and the population must be protected. And today, with the civil society organization group, they said justice is important. That is why we have said to the government that all perpetrators be brought to justice.
So far, no one in Burkina Faso has been convicted of extrajudicial killings against civilians. Daouda Diallo runs the Collective Against Impunity and the Stigmatization of Communities, a Burkinabe human rights group. He told VOA it's important to respect the commitments of Burkina Faso at the regional and international levels because it has signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Most human rights abuses, however, are being carried out by armed groups, not security forces. Ousmane Diallo is a researcher on Burkina Faso for Amnesty International.
The Islamic State in the Greater Sahara has willfully targeted civilians and committed mass atrocities against them. I think one of the most symbolic case was the attack on Solhan in June 2021.
At the beginning of June, Burkina Faso saw the worst terrorist attack on civilians since the conflict with armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State started. At least 138 people were killed in the village of Solhan. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
In other news, Chancellor Angela Merkel has called on Germans to stand up to hatred at a military ceremony bidding her farewell after 16 years in office. Merkel was honored with a traditional military musical performance and march in front of almost all the country's political elite. The far-right alternative for Germany wasn't invited. In a speech ahead of the ceremony Thursday, she said that, quote, "Whatever hatred and violence are seen as a legitimate means of pursuing one's interests, our tolerance as Democrats has to find its limit," unquote. The event, held at a defense ministry rather than in a more public setting due to pandemic constraints, involved a parade and a brass band playing songs Merkel chose, including a punk piece. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Australia's centre-right government is being urged to implement recommendations of a report saying a third of workers in the federal parliament have been sexually harassed. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins has recommended a significant overhaul of the federal parliament's workplace culture. Her report, released Tuesday, called Set the Standard, found that 51% of parliamentary staff members in Canberra had experienced some form of bullying and sexual harassment, as well as actual or attempted sexual assault. The victims were disproportionately women. Jenkins said the situation has been devastating for individuals and undermined Parliament's performance. The inquiry was launched after a former political staffer, Brittany Higgins, said she'd been raped by a colleague in a minister's office. It resulted in a wave of wide-ranging allegations of misconduct in Canberra and beyond. Nikki Vincent, Victoria State's Public Sector Gender Equality Commissioner, is investigating workplace sexual harassment in 300 public organisations, including universities and local councils.
This last couple of years, you know, have really highlighted the issues of sexual harassment and its relationship to gender inequality. Any organisation that's not on alert around sexual harassment these days is burying its head in the sand and is being rather ridiculous.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison called the Set the Standard report's findings appalling. He's being urged by campaigners to implement the report's recommendations, including gender balances among parliamentary staff and politicians, and reducing a culture that tolerates excessive alcohol consumption. Higgins said she wanted to thank the many brave people who shared their stories, which contributed to this review. The man accused of raping Higgins has denied the allegation and is set to face trial next year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The tale of two Sudanese brothers recently rescued in the Mediterranean Sea is a common one among the many African migrants seeking a better life in Europe. The two men set sail from Libya on a flimsy boat, but the engine broke down and they were eventually picked up by the Ocean Viking rescue ship. Reporter Ruth Emendorf was on board that rescue vessel and has their story.
Bo Mayen, alias Colomba, and his brother, Gad Quoth, were posting regularly on Facebook while living in Libya. But the two South Sudanese brothers suddenly stopped posting at the end of October. And that's because they were at sea, rescued on November 2nd by the Ocean Viking, after the engine on their flimsy boat broke down in the middle of the Mediterranean.
When I was in little ship, I think about I'm going to die now. I think that I'm dying. There's nothing else could help me.
The two left South Sudan in 2015 with friends and made their way to Libya, where they found work. But life was hard in the war-torn country, so they decided to leave for Europe, says Gad Quoth Mayen and his friend George.
Libya is too much for me.
Why?
They arrest me and they beat me. And when I go to work, maybe they cannot fail me. Yeah.
Maybe you have money. The robbers, they came and take your money. Maybe they kill you. That is why I decided to go to Europe.
On board the rescue vessel, the brothers passed the time playing cards and chatting with fellow migrants. Then an announcement comes they are going to Italy. With this promising outlook, the time comes to think about the future in Europe.
In Europe, I have to find my talent. I play basketball, and also I'm an engineer. My dream, I want to play with the basketball. But if not, maybe I will continue for my education if there is no chance to play with basketball.
Walking the gangway to shore in Augusta, Sicily, a new life with its own challenges and dreams awaits them. Ruth Elmendorf for VOA News in Sicily.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chin Edwafo in Washington, wishing you a great weekend.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.